everybody with a phone. You need a smartphone. You need to be able to go to the use the internet. So open your phone up, open your internet, right? I would like you to just type in your little search bar there the simple words redemptiontukwila.com. Redemptiontukwila.com. This is our webpage. Has anybody been there before? We just have, we have one person who's been there. Redemptiontukwila.com. Just, that's as easy as it gets right there. Redemptiontukwila.com. That webpage updates weekly. Okay? Everything that happens here on Sunday morning, every announcement that is made, is on that webpage. You can go to that webpage and find out all kinds of things. If you hit the little drop-down menu that's up in the thing, you'll see there's a home and about us, and pretty soon there's going to be sermons posted on there. And you can go, well, there's a sermon posted on there now, you just can't listen to it because the audio is not good. We're working on it, and hopefully those will be posted there. And but there's things down there. There's a bulletin, and that bulletin is all of our upcoming stuff that is there. We have a giving page. Let's say you just desperately wanted to give some more money to the church for some reason. I don't know why. You can go to our giving page, and just put in the amount you want to give, and boom, you can donate right online. It's all there on our incredible web page. We've had this page for a while now, but it's not getting used. People aren't going there. So I just encourage you to go there to take a look at the web page from time to time. There's also a community page, and that community page links you to all of us. And it is our own community, and we can communicate with each other through that community page. We can send each other Bible verses and prayer requests. All of those things can be done via that community page. I am the only member of the community right now. I have been the only member of the community for a number of years, and I'm lonely. I would love for other people to come join me and be part of the community, but that is our web page. And of course, you've been to our Facebook page, right? How many of you have been to our Facebook page? Okay. Do you check in periodically? The more check-ins we get, the more exposure we get, literally. And also, if you like us, the more likes we get, the more exposure we get as well. And so it is free advertising. When you check in, or when you like the page, or when you give us a review. Reviews are awesome. I think we have two reviews. One of them is mine. I think I go on glowingly about the pastor and his preaching, you know, how good looking, you know. And I think Michelle Tarana has also put in a review. But put in your review. Do you like our church? What do you like about it? No bad reviews, please. All of your reviews must be 5-star reviews, okay? If I see one of you that put in a 4-star or 3-star or something less review, that's it. You're getting excommunicated. I know we don't practice shunning, but we're going to start if you do that. So those are a couple of resources that we don't talk about often enough here, but that are something that you may want to use. And again, if you miss a sermon, go to the webpage and you can check it out and see if how we're doing. We need some feedback on that, if the audio is good. We're not going to do a lot of editing of the sermons, because it's just a lot of time invested. We just want to get them up there, and so your feedback on how they sound and things like that will help us to kind of correct some things. So, I was single till I was 30 years old, When I graduated from high school, I almost got married. I was dated a girl all the way through high school. I'm going to sing a song to her, actually, this week. Please don't come and listen, though. No, I actually got roped into singing in a choir, and I have a solo, and the song is "Oh Donna," and they asked me if I would sing the lead line for that, and so I'm going to go and sing a song that I used to sing to my high school girlfriend frequently. Didn't get married. Found myself in the Army and single, and being a wizened 21, 22-year-old young man, I was discipling a young married man. He had gotten married at about 18, 19 years old, and he and his wife were, he sang in the chorus with me, and he thought that I could tell him something about, I don't know. Anyway, we got talking and during one of our discipleship things, and he was going on and on about how lucky I was to be a single person and how glorious it was to be single. I said, you're kidding me, right? I said, I'm just dying to be married, you know. I said, I almost got married, really wanted to be married, and I said, wait a minute. We've got it backwards. You're looking at my life and thinking about all the marvels of being single, and I'm looking at your life and thinking about all the marvels of being married. And I said, we need to do the exact opposite. You need to be looking at where you're at, and you need to make a list of all of the wonderful things about being married and how good it is to be married. And I said, I need to make my list about how good it is to be single and all the wonderful aspects about being single. And so I came up with my list. I actually wrote down in my journal a list of a number of things that about being single, and it did me well. In fact, by the time I was 30, I did not want to get married. I was desperately trying not to get married, and fortunately, Dolly persisted. And she tracked me down. I have read a couple of articles this week about the advantages of single. Could we bring up the first slide there? Go past the passage. We'll come back to that. Here, yeah, the advantages of being single. And so you can travel on a whim, flirt without fear. I think that's flirt with, this is not my list, by the way. Flirt without fear of spousal reprisal, I think, is what that is. You can work on yourself. Saves time. You can sleep in peace unless you have a cat. You can become more self-reliant, stay in touch with friends easier, avoid a bad match. Yes, it's nothing worse than, the only thing worse than being single is being unhappily married. And you can do whatever you want. Right? Now, bring up the advantages of being married. There we go. Now, the advantages of being married, you live longer. Live healthier. In fact, the studies have shown that you recover more quickly from illness and that you're less likely to get serious illnesses. It's equal to being in an age category 10 years younger than you actually are. People who are married are 3.4 times more likely to report being generally happy than those who just cohabitate, and it's wealthier. Now, I'm looking at these two lists from these two different articles. I'm going, okay, marriage wins. You know, marriage wins in this battle. I need to come up with a way better list than the one this guy came up with, because I can do, go back to the singles one. I can do all this while I'm married. So anyway, I didn't think that was a very good list. We are going to come up with that list, however. It's just going to happen later on. And Paul is going to tell us some decent reasons for why it is good to be a single person. So being single for 30 years, actually enjoyed it, was just like, other than looking at my parents and my friends and stuff. I've often told the story that when I went to weddings at that age, I frequently would sit in the church and I would want to stand up and scream at these people, you know. Do you know what you're saying? Do you have any idea what you're committing yourself to? Because they're making these incredible vows. And for me, it was just very frightening, and I was certain that nobody knew what they were doing. And now I know that they don't know what they're doing. It was easy. It was easy being single. It's more difficult now, I think, being single again. I think is more difficult having had a good marriage and now knowing. In fact, I frequently told my wife, I said, if I knew it was going to be this much fun, I said, I'd have gotten married a long time ago. Because it was great. And now to not have that, I think, is harder being single now and the struggles of being single. But it's something that we all have to struggle with at some point or another in our lives. We all have to struggle with it on the first part of our lives, and one or other of you is going to struggle with it on the end of your life. So Paul deals with this whole concept this morning of marriage and singleness, and he doesn't leave anybody out. Everybody gets to be a part of this conversation about whether or not it is a good thing to either be married or single. And so if you're there in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, let me read the first 9 verses for you. Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to marry. But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband in the same way the husband's body doesn't belong to him alone, but also to his wife. And don't deprive each other, except by mutual consent and foretime, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am. But each man has his own gift from God. One has a gift, another has that gift. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it's good for them to stay unmarried as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. So lots of misinformation and misunderstanding about this passage of Scripture. And hopefully we can kind of clear up some of the things this morning. The first misconception is that Paul is actually telling people it's good for a man not to marry. Paul is not giving an instruction about this. This was a motto or a slogan that he was addressing that was going on in the Corinthian church. So you have all of these factions in the Corinthian church, right? We've talked about those from the very beginning. And each faction is following various leaders. But each faction is also influenced by the Greek culture and the Roman culture that is going on at that time. And so we talked last week about one aspect of these factions, and that was the Liberty Group. There was a group of them who said, because of our freedom in Christ and because the body really means nothing in all of eternity, we can do whatever we want in the body. We only have to nurture the soul. And so there was rampant sexual immorality, and in fact, we actually talked about the guy who was having an incestuous relationship with his mother as a result of this liberty that they had. But there's another group, and these were the ascetics, and they practiced asceticism, and because the body didn't matter, they deprived it. And in fact, they bought into the whole Platonic aspect of spirituality. That in sex, I'm also, again, you may want to take your children out at some point or another, recover their ears. For them was unspiritual. That if you could live a life without sex, you were more spiritual and more holy. To deprive the body of this was a holy and righteous thing to do. So they even espoused Platonic relationships within marriage. So the couples would get married and they would have a companionship, but they would not have relations with one another. And so there were these two factions in the church. One was this ascetic, you know, depriving the body, and the other was indulging the body and everything. So He's addressing one of those groups that say it's good for a man not to marry. It actually should be translated as good for a man not to touch a woman. That has all kinds of sexual connotations to it. It's good for a man not to touch a woman. He's going to spend the next several verses here kind of bringing balance to this whole thing. He's also not saying that sexual immorality is the main reason why you should get married. He's just addressing the issue that, hey, there's a lot of sexual immorality in your town, and so it's a good idea for men and women to be married because this is a problem for you guys. He goes on in other passages and talks about the value and the beauty of marriage and the reasons why couples ought to be married. He's just addressing the issues of sexual immorality and this Platonism. So he goes on in verses 3 to 5. He says, the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife and likewise the wife to her husband. I'm not going to describe to you what the marital duty is. You know what he's talking about here. It's odd that he describes it as a duty. It's a strange thing to describe this intimacy with one another as a duty. But again, this is not a response to what sex is supposed to be in a marriage. It's a response to the fact that there were people who were saying that it ought not to happen at all. And so he said, no, this is something that needs to be a part of your marriage. And there you have this duty, this responsibility to one another to hedge the sexual desires by putting them in the right context. And if you don't do this, then you are failing in your responsibility as a spouse to maintain the purity of the marriage and to protect each other from sexual immorality. That's why he uses the word duty. He doesn't consider it some kind of obligation. He considers it something that is necessary for each other's protection. And then he says something that is highly revolutionary and in this culture and in this context would have been very, very hard to swallow. He says, first, the wife's body does not belong to her alone but also her husband. And everybody in the Greek, Roman, and Jewish culture would have said, of course. Yes, the wife is possessed. You know, we own, she's property to us. But then he says, in the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. This idea of mutuality within marriage was completely novel, completely new to them. This was a concept that the church initiated and that began to get traction. Up to this point in time, there isn't a culture that exists that has this kind of mutuality. Women were not given this kind of equality or freedom in marriage up to this point. Even in Jewish cultures, although in Jewish cultures it was better, it was still very patriarchal. At the altar, there is an exchange that takes place. There is an exchange of power that takes place. And we give each other at the altar power. You are now going to have power over me. And I am going to have power over you. We're going to possess one another. This idea of oneness, and if you explore this idea of oneness throughout Scripture, it goes way, way beyond just the physical act of intercourse. There's this oneness in everything, in the whole aspect of the marriage. And part of it is this possessing one another in a way that is mutual. It's a very interesting concept and one that I think we don't explore deeply enough. He He talks about the whole idea of deprivation. He says, don't deprive each other except by mutual consent for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. So that the only context he gives for withholding sexual intimacy in the marriage is that you've agreed upon it and you've determined that you're going to spend some time practicing one of the spiritual disciplines together. And then that is supposed to be for a designated time, and then you're to come back together. So that the idea that Paul is giving here for those people who are married is really simple. There's a connectedness between sexual intimacy and marriage that is inescapable. And that if you have one, that you ought to have the other. Sex apart from marriage is, that's not right. And marriage apart from sex, well, that's not right. The two of them are linked together. And so he's just trying to encourage, again, he's battling this whole idea of asceticism, that there is something spiritual about not having sexual intimacy. He's going, no, that's not true. It's part and parcel of the whole deal of getting married. By the way, that wasn't on the list, was it? Should have been on the list. He goes on and he makes this concession now. His concession that he's making, he actually says that, right? He says, I say this as a concession. Yeah, I say this as a concession, not as a command. His concession is to the ascetics. So he's saying to these people who are espousing, you know, the depriving each other of sexual relations, he's saying to them, I'm going to concede something to you. That yes, there are advantages to the celibate lifestyle. He doesn't want to diminish the fact that there are advantages to this lifestyle. And so he says, my concession is this. Yeah, I'm single. I wish everybody was like me. But I understand that that is not necessarily possible for everybody. So he brings this balance. He concedes that celibacy in the context of singleness can be a good thing. But then he recognizes and he introduces a very odd spiritual gift. The gift of celibacy. I remember as a, you know, a young man, people talking about, you know, various spiritual gifts. I'm going, I don't want that gift, you know. Obviously, not wanting the gift means that you probably don't have it. But Paul recognizes this diversity within the body of Christ, and that there are some, and Jesus also mentions this. He says some are eunuchs by choice, right? Others who are not eunuchs by choice, but he said, you know, there is this giftedness, and Paul agrees. Yet in the context of singleness, celibacy can be a good thing. And so, and then finally in verses 8 and 9, he addresses a completely different group, those who were once married and have now been widowed. He says, now to the unmarried. Really, that should be more specific. They didn't have a term for widowers in the Greek at this point. Their word was introduced later. But at this point, there was no word for widower. So often what they would do, they would use the term unmarried, but they would use the masculine form of unmarried to indicate a widower. So this probably should be translated to widowers and to the widows. Here is advice for you. And his advice to them is it's good for them to stay unmarried as he is. This is an indication, by the way, that Paul may be a widower. We know that he's single. We always had this kind of argument within the church about whether or not Paul was ever married, because rabbis, and particularly those who were part of the Sanhedrin, were required to be married, and Paul was a rabbi and being trained by the Sanhedrin. And so it would have been a requirement for him to be married. What we don't know is that if he had completed his schooling or not, and whether or not he left the Sanhedrin prior to getting married, or whether he got married and then his wife died, then it's just not recorded. That's possible here when he says that you remain as I am, that maybe he was widowed, that he had gotten married as this requirement was made when he was in school, and that she died somehow. We don't know. All speculation. I just throw it out there for your information. He says, for these folks, it's a good thing to remain unmarried like him. And he's going to explain why later on. It's a good thing for them to remain unmarried. He wishes that everybody had the same kind of life that he did, without the distractions of marriage. But he says then in verse 9, again, trying to bring balance. He just keeps trying to bring balance to this whole issue. If they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it's better to marry than to burn with passion. So, you know, those widows or widowers who go on to remarry, they are just weak, and, you know, we ought to kind of bow our heads and go, yeah, too bad for them. They have to get remarried because they are they're so weak. I think he takes a dig at widows and widowers here. But he wants everyone to be in a context where they are exercising the proper gift and they are not setting themselves up for some kind of moral failure. That's the balance that he's trying to bring. If you're married, you ought to be having lots of sexual relations. If you're not, you ought to be having none. And regardless of whatever context you're in, you ought to rejoice in that. And you ought to use that to build the kingdom and to be part of the kingdom. And, sheesh. I'm just trying to think if I have to preach any more on sex before this is over, because there's two things that are hard for a pastor to preach on. One is sex, and the other is money. And I think we're going to get to money later. So, who asked me to preach through 1 Corinthians, Betsy? few points of application here. Regarding the whole issue of asceticism or depriving the body and sexual immorality, I kind of wish in our culture that there were some ascetics out there. We do not have to worry about that faction. I do not know of anybody who deprives themselves of anything, let alone sex in our culture. We are weighted heavily towards sexual immorality. In fact, the basic assumption for anybody who is dating longer than a few weeks in our culture is that they're sleeping together. It's true in the church as well. We view sex in our culture as a right. We view sex as a need that needs to be satisfied. In our culture, the thought of people going through life without sex is a travesty to us. And we make all kinds of allowances. I serve on a advisory board for a young man, and he's a single young man, and he has some issues, and he has a girlfriend. They are both developmentally disabled, and so I am the lone Christian voice on this panel. They are doing everything they can to try to get these couples alone so that they can have sex, because the idea that they would not be able to have sex at some point in their life is completely anathema to them. They can't imagine that we would deprive them of this. And I'm just saying, okay, have you considered the ramifications and implications of what's going to happen if you do this? Because there's all kinds of fallout that is going to take place as a result of this rendezvous that you guys are all trying to set up. And the only thing that I can do is appeal to his sense of morality. And he's the only one who can stop this. But it's just the whole mindset of our culture. Everybody should be having sex and whenever they want, and no one should be deprived of it. We find so much identity in sexuality that it colors everything that we do in our culture. The fact is simple. Whether you have the gift of celibacy or not, you're all called to it at some point or another. We are all called to practice celibacy at some point in our lives. We're instructed to exercise self-control. Is it really so inconceivable that we can actually rule over our bodies? Is it so inconceivable that we can actually tell our bodies what it ought to do? I remember coaching Little League. I loved coaching Little League. It was a great thing. And I would tell the little boys and girls who are on my team, I said, before the ball is hit, I said, you tell your body what to do. Don't let the ball tell you what you're going to do. Don't let anybody else in the field tell you what you're going to do. You tell your body what you want it to do on this next play. And I said, I want you to think about that every time the ball is hit. What do I want my body to do? Why can't we do that as adults? I want my body to eat this, not this. I don't have to have sex outside of the context of marriage. I can watch what I want on TV, and I can turn off what I don't want to watch on TV. I can read things that are good for me, and I don't have to read things that are bad for me. I mean, is this such a wild concept? Is the church the only place where you're going to get that message? It's baffling to me. But anyway, marital duty, I spoke about this at length last week. I don't want to talk about it much anymore. I just want to add this. And I've had to deal with this many times in marriage counseling. There is no room in any marriage where sex is used to manipulate, barter, or punish the other person. And I have seen all three. You know, honey, you know, I will do this if I can buy this. You know, or, you know, if you don't behave, you know, you can sleep on the couch or, you know, go on from there. Numbers of different ways that we use sex as some kind of tool or instrument to manipulate or to get what we want. We call that prostitution in any other context. Given the whole concept of possessing your partner's body, I would remind you that you are to possess that body like Jesus would, not as you would. Yeah, you possess your partner's body, but you possess that body in the light of how Jesus would possess that body, not in the light of how you would use it or abuse it. So this means that you will always have their welfare in mind. And so sometimes your greatest act of love in marriage maybe leaving your spouse alone or embracing them even when you don't feel like it. I'm going to throw in a joke here just because it's way too serious. I read a Reader's Digest. A couple of guys were talking about a guy had just bought new beds. And he bought two single beds in the bedroom, and his buddy goes, "Well, you have single beds. What's up with that?" And he goes, "Ah, no, just sleep way more comfortably." He says, "So, how do you know it's going to happen or not?" He says, "Well, my hat." He goes, "Your hat?" He goes, "Yeah, I use my hat." He goes, what? He goes, so I keep my hat by my bed, and I throw it over to her before I go to sleep. Sometimes she brings it back. Sometimes she throws it back. Good. I should have used that joke for the joke night, huh? It's an eye. Good, good. I'm getting residual laughs out of that joke. Lastly, just regarding this idea of giftedness, the gift of celibacy is a gift that you'll be aware of if you have it, but it is also something that can be nurtured if you don't have it. I can attest to this, being single now at two different periods of time in my life. It is something that can be nurtured and can be practiced, and there can be a joy in it. It's, you know, sometimes it is foisted upon you. But nevertheless, we have to find contentment in whatever context we're put in, rather than pining or longing for something that somebody else has. And so, in whatever context Jesus has placed you right now, find contentment in that. If you're married, find joy in that. Delight in each other. And if you're single, find joy in that and delight in it, instead of always looking at what you don't have and then wishing you had what you used to have after you get what you wanted in the first place. So, just a reminder in closing before we go to communion that during this Lenten season, would like you to prepare for Holy Week that's coming up here.